From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Women's roles have changed dramatically in the last few decades. Women now share the same career aspirations as men and are still loving mothers. They make sacrifices, but it's their nannies who often pay the highest price, says the Atlantic Monthly's Caitlin Flanagan. Tonight on Point, how professional class working women get ahead on the backs of their nannies. But first, Iranians went to the polls today to vote in parliamentary elections. Turnout was low as voters apparently lost their enthusiasm for an election where more than 2,000 liberal candidates were disqualified by clerics. Babak Daganpache is foreign correspondent for Newsweek. I asked him about the mood of voters there after so many candidates were forced to drop out.
It definitely made a big difference for those people who didn't turn out today. A lot of Iranians who have been supporting the reform movement didn't really know many of the candidates who were campaigning today. And, you know, as two of the major reform parties weren't participating, many of them decided not to go to the polls. There was even a text message that was widely distributed on cell phones in Tehran that encouraged people to stay away from the polls, saying that the polls today would be the coffin of democracy.
Well, as you know, President Khatami had been promising that he was going to hold fair and free parliamentary elections. Could you describe the election today as either fair or free?
Well, it depends on how you see the events leading up to the elections. I mean, the elections themselves, in terms of the voting process, was, I suppose, went according to plan. But certainly the fact that a large number of candidates, several hundred, you know, were disqualified leading up to the elections, it would hardly seem fair because many of the choices of Iranians who had voted those candidates in the previous parliamentary election into power, those candidates weren't on the ballot today.
And did President Khatami go along with the fact that they were disqualified, or was there really anything he could have done about that?
Well, it was really out of his hands. The body that disqualified the candidates is the Guardian Council, and, you know, there's sort of a complex set of restrictions or criteria that they can use to disqualify the candidates. And after the Iranian Supreme Leader weighed in and said the elections would go ahead today, Khatami, it appears, was really between a rock and a hard place. He really had not much choice but to go ahead with it.
And I understand that there were two of the leading reformist newspapers that were shut down yesterday, just one day before the election. Did that seem to upset people?
That's correct. Two of the reformist newspapers, one is called Yasino, the other one is called Sharq, were both shut down yesterday. The reason behind that is that a number of reformist parliamentarians who had resigned in protest of the disqualifications in the lead-up to this election issued a letter the previous day saying criticizing the Supreme Leader, which is generally not done here in public. And those two newspapers had chosen to publish portions of this letter, which was a very controversial decision and did lead to them being shut down. In terms of protests about the newspapers being shut down, no, there really haven't been any protests, although definitely limits the choice that newspaper readers in Iran will have because there's really not many other reformist newspapers left after these two.
Well, what's your read on the mood these days? Are people angry and frustrated about what's happening there, and particularly in terms of this election, or do they seem more resigned?
People are frustrated. They've lost hope in the reform movement. They really, at this point, they see the protests and the resignations of the reformist parliamentarians as just sort of self-serving. They think the reformists had their time in office, and they could have done more while they were there. So, you know, at the moment, it seems like a lot of people have lost faith in the electoral process and, I suppose, resigned to, you know, whatever comes out of this election.
Mm. And does there seem to be a clear alternative at this point, or is it you have to live with what you have until one appears?
Keeping in mind the mass number of disqualifications, you know, it seems like the choice of this election is more or less pretty much predetermined. So there is very few other alternatives or choices for the people at the moment.
But doesn't that mean that the onus is now on the conservatives who will be controlling parliament? Don't they have to come up with something positive to keep in power?
Yes, that's actually a good point. You know, the one thing that analysts here in Iran have been mentioning in recent months is that conservatives will try to win over when people support by sort of appealing to their pocketbooks in a way, by pushing through economic reforms that will address the relatively high unemployment rate. The unemployment rate's estimated somewhere between 15 and 20%. If they are able to create jobs, if they're, you know, able to bring down some of the high prices for goods like meat that a lot of average Iranians can't afford and complain about, then, you know, that will get them some support. It's a tangible benefit that maybe people can point to. So, yes, the onus is definitely on them to sort of deliver and, you know, win over the people's hearts and minds, I suppose, at this point.
Well, we'll be watching it as you will, Babak. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Babak Deganpache is a foreign correspondent for Newsweek. He spoke with me from Tehran. The Atlantic Monthly's Caitlin Flanagan asks how so many middle-class American women went from not wanting to oppress other women to viewing that oppression as a central part of their own liberation. The women she says they're oppressing, they're nannies. Flanagan has a nanny who has made it possible for her to pursue a career in writing and who, she says, she pays fairly. But many households with nannies, including $500,000-plus households, pay their nannies less than a living wage, and they do so under the table to avoid taxes. Tonight on Point, how serfdom saved the women's movement. Does Caitlin Flanagan's thesis offend or ring true to you? Are you a working mother with a nanny? And if so, do you worry that your nanny may be suffering at your expense? Have nannies saved fathers from doing their fair share? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now is Caitlin Flanagan, contributing editor to The Atlantic Monthly, and her article, How Serfdom Saved the Women's Movement, appears in the current issue of the magazine. She also has a forthcoming book titled Housewife Heaven. So welcome, Caitlin, or maybe I should say welcome back. It's good to have you with us again.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
I'd be interested in hearing a little bit about your personal story first, because as you point out, you yourself are only a couple of generations removed from perhaps being one of those poor immigrant women who cooked and cleaned and raised the children of other women.
Well, it's funny. As an Irish-American, I'm 42, and when I was a girl, my nickname at home, the name I was always called was Kate, but I heard so many older people in the family, Irish people in the family, make a joke, half-joking, half-serious, that Kate is a servant's name, Kate's a maid's name. And that was part of why, when I was in ninth grade, I claimed my formal first name of Caitlin. But now, by, you know, the year 2004, I don't think there's a person left in America who associates an Irish woman with domestic work anymore. But it certainly was in the past of Irish Americans, and it was certainly on my mind very much as I started thinking and working and writing about domestic workers in this country.
Hmm. And you chose to remain home when your twin sons were born. What prompted you to make that choice?
You know, it's funny. A lot of people think that I must have given up some wonderful career or something to do it. I was, as a girl growing up, again, I think generationally, I must have been the very last gasp of girls who really grew up with one thing on their mind, being a mom and being a housewife and running a home. And although there are plenty of women my generation who certainly are doing much more extraordinary things in the outside world than that, I was one of those little girls in the 60s who ironed things on a little fake ironing board and so forth. And, you know, when I graduated from college, I thought a good thing to do would be a school teacher. And that was a nice thing for a woman to do before she settled down and got married. And that's what I was. So I absolutely intended to be home with children and making a home, you know, once I was married. And so I quit even before I got pregnant, as a matter of fact. And this writing thing kind of developed. It's a wonderful pastime, and, you know, it's gone beyond a hobby at this point. But it developed after having had the children, actually.
Well, and it's interesting to me that you are honest enough to acknowledge that here you are with a graduate degree, and clearly all that expensive education isn't necessarily required to play Legos for hours on end. But you also say that you would, given your choice, rather sit next to a working woman at a dinner party.
Well, you know, as I said in the interview that I think you're referring to, you're never supposed to admit that. And I, you know, it'll sound funny to say some of my best friends are at-home mothers, and truly they are. However, if I'm at a dinner party with a group of people whom I don't know, and there's a woman who's maybe a pediatric nurse, and there's a woman who maybe is a writer or an attorney or something like that, or a teacher at a school, and then there's someone who's at home full-time with the kids, I think, oh, gosh, don't let me sit next to that one. It's going to be all those things about the children, and it's going to really drag down the conversation. And I'd like to sit next to that nurse and hear what's going on in the hospital. I find the world of adult discussion and the world of business and the world of healthcare and all that, for me, I'm just much more interested in that than I am in the day-to-day of child raising.
But I wonder if you were surprised, as I was, when I was first at home with my son, thinking, nobody told me this was so hard. You know, it's really difficult to be home with a baby for hours on end. And, you know, you're lucky in the early hours and days and weeks to get your face washed by 5 o'clock in the afternoon.
You know, I used the expression that I think resonated with a lot of readers in the essay. I used the phrase mild depression. And there have actually been studies, as a matter of fact, that have found that an awful lot of women home full-time with very small children are suffering legitimately from mild clinical depression. There's that underwater feeling that you can't shake and that, you know, people try to tell you about it. And then you try to tell others about it, but nobody can understand until they're there. It's a very slow, murky experience filled with utterly transcendent moments. And you get more of those transcendent moments if you're around for more of the utter murky times than if you don't. And that's certainly a bind. And I think that's what so many people are talking about in America today.
And you also write about something that perhaps some of us haven't thought about, and that is how much nannies get attached to the children that they're taking care of, and that, in fact, that may be very threatening to the mom who may not want to be there for every single moment or who may not be able to be there for every single moment, but doesn't want Johnny and Susie necessarily to get too fond of the nanny either.
It's a very difficult thing for women, I think. And this is one of the ways that our nanny culture in after the year 2000 here in America is so different from other nanny cultures in the past. If we think about the prime example of nanny culture to all of us, I think would be Victorian and Edwardian England. And in those days in England, there was a real cult of motherhood, and there was no conflict at all between who the matriarch of the family was, who the wife was, and who the mother was, that important female angel in the home, angel in the house. But she didn't spend very much time with her children. She didn't change those nappies. She didn't push the pram. You really hardly ever see a photograph of a well-heeled Victorian lady of the house wheeling a pram. The nanny did that, and there was no conflict there. There was no tension about that. But in our day and age, the kind of role model that we're all wrestling with on one level or another is that 50s, 60s housewife who really raised the children herself. And so we're always wondering, how much can the nanny do and I'll still be the mother? Can the nanny do the bath every night and will I still be the mother? Can the nanny rock the baby to sleep every day for the nap and I'll still be the mother? What can I do? How much can I not do and still be the mother? And I think it's something that we're all kind of figuring out right now. And I think in 10 or 15 years, one way or another, we will have figured it out. But I think when social historians look back on our time and place, they'll see it as a time of struggle dealing with this issue. We're not really sure where the chips are going to come down yet.
And also, we just have a couple seconds before we have to take a break, but there's also the economic piece, which is there's not the old family retainer anymore either.
This is a huge part of it, and this is what really motivated my essay. Nannies certainly made an awful lot less money in, say, the times of the segregated South in this country. They were treated horribly compared to the typical nanny at an upper-middle-class household today. But there was a sense that in one way or another, that mammy or that maid was, if it was a good family, that that family had some responsibility to that woman over the course of her life. Nowadays, we turn these women over very quickly. They're in our houses for 2 years or 3 years, and they don't have any retirement package, and if we haven't paid Social Security, they're going to be in really hot water when they retire.
All right, well, hold that thought. We're going to get back to it. We're talking tonight about how serfdom saved the women's movement. Is it possible for a woman to have a career and a family without the help of a nanny? What can the government do to stop the exploitation of domestic workers? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harris, in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about women exploiting other women to get ahead in their careers. Are you a working mother who gets by without a nanny? How do you do it? What do you think about Caitlin Flanagan's thesis? Is that just the way the market works? Or if nannies are being exploited, should someone, perhaps the government, step in to stop it? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're talking with Caitlin Flanagan, contributing editor to The Atlantic Monthly. Her article, How Serfdom Saved the Women's Movement, is in the current issue of the magazine. And joining me now from South Pasadena, California, is Perette Hondenyu Sotelo. She is an associate professor of sociology at the University of Southern California and author of Domestica, Immigrant Workers Cleaning and Caring in the Shadows of Affluence. Perette, welcome to you.
Thank you. Thanks for the invitation.
And Caitlin Flanagan says that your book literally changed her life. I'll ask her to speak to that in a moment. But what do you think made your book different and made it an eye-opener? I assume that's not the first time you've gotten that reaction.
Well, that's very nice to hear. I think the material just really speaks for itself. And this is an issue that's not going away. It's an issue that's not particular only to Los Angeles or to the United States. It's a new global issue that we're facing. And what I try to do in my book is provide a perspective, some insight into both the employees, the nannies' experience, as well as the experience of employers, the women that hire them. So I attempt to sort of connect what goes on inside these households with what's going on in this larger global world system.
And in fact, you have a personal story as well. You are the daughter of a domestic worker. What was your experience growing up?
Well, my mother came here from Chile many years ago, and she came as a live-in nanny with an American family. During those years, it wasn't quite as common for, let's say, middle-class dual career families to be employing Latina domestic workers. But what we've seen in the last 30 years with the growth of globalization and immigration worldwide is a virtual explosion in the employment of Latina and Caribbean and Filipina and Indian and domestic workers in just about every post-industrial nation around the globe. So there's some real marked differences. Nannies, I think, as Caitlin's article outlines very well, nannies are no longer the privilege of the very wealthy, but are instead employed by a wide range of families at various income levels.
So, Caitlin, how did Perette's book change your life?
I can remember the moment that I was reading it. I review books a lot for The Atlantic, and I get sent a big pile of them in big envelopes all the time. And this book came out with its blue cover, and I settled down on my bed to read it. And within 20 pages, I was shocked. And I'll tell you why. There have been a lot of books that really dealt before with different kinds of domestic workers and their employers, both sides of the story, between women, domestics, and their employers, dealt with African-American domestics in Boston, and Aaron's Daughters in America dealt with Irish workers in the turn of the century Boston and in New York. But this book, as Perette's saying, dealt very specifically with a situation that was going on in my own home, having a Latina nanny and being an Anglo woman and living in Southern California. And I felt as though someone were describing in the most precise and intimate terms the very stuff of my daily life. And the shock for me came from the fact that when I was a girl growing up in California, my mother was very liberal, and I was very proud of my mother. I was proud of both my parents. I was proud of their politics. And one of the things that my mother was very involved with was Cesar Chavez's United Farm Workers movement. And we boycotted table grapes for years, and we boycotted many. My mother always knew which crop was being struck at which point, and we boycotted that. And we really sided with the workers and against the growers, and we really imagined the growers as big, coarse, fat, white men oppressing these immigrant workers. And I read the book, and suddenly I realized, I'm not like my mother helping the immigrants and fighting for social justice. I'm like the growers, capitalizing for my own personal happiness on the poverty that brings people here. And I felt truly ashamed. Now, the issue of exploitation is it's a really... It's a tough one. And I've been in this Slate magazine discussion the last 3 days, and people are furious with me for even, saying that nannies are oppressed, given that their hourly wage is often much higher than the minimum wage. And when you think of things that I've done for my nanny, I've done things for her that no job ever did for me. You know, when she's needed money, I've helped her out. No job ever did that for me. And given her lots of time off when things have gone on in her personal life that I wouldn't have asked an employer for, it's a very intimate relationship of give and take. But what really prompted me to think about exploitation was that there's a big movement in contemporary feminism which says, it started really by Anne Crittenden, who wrote The Price of Motherhood, and it says that, gosh, isn't it wrong that when women choose to leave careers, that they give up their Social Security credits and they don't earn them anymore and they get a string of zeros? And I thought, wow, well, that is true. But isn't it also true that there are all these domestic workers not getting Social Security set-asides? And isn't it true that, you know, you need 40 Social Security credits to qualify for Social Security benefits? It takes 10 years to get them. What if a nanny's going from job to job to job? She'll be in much worse shape than the professional class woman will be, who's got her husband who's still working as a lawyer or whatever. And all these ideas came together, and it was just a very powerful reading experience.
Mm. And Perrette, where do you draw that line? Because legitimately, many of these women, if not all these women, need money to put food on their tables.
That's
so
right.
Do they feel like they're being exploited?
You know, it's a mixed bag. I think domestic workers, Latina nannies and others, are very discerning about their employers and are quick to note exploitative, you know, draw the line at exploitative treatment, and if possible, leave those jobs for better ones. The problem is it's not always possible. In an ideal world, they would have those options. So women are, you know, divided by their own financial urgencies, their legal status, their own skills with English and certification and what have you. I'm very moved to hear Caitlin's story, and I think I've thought all along employers act not out of largely not out of malice or some essentialized evil, but often out of ignorance. Most American employers, women and men who employ nannies, do not see themselves as employers. They identify as parents, they identify with their occupation, and really have very little understanding about the consequence of the employment relations that they have in their home for the woman who's taking care of their children and perhaps for the children of the nanny as well. Mm. So it's my hope that articles such as Caitlin Flanagan's, my book, plays, all kinds of media will help to sort of plant this seed of consciousness. And I think I want to emphasize also that there are reform movements on the ground, not to abolish paid domestic work. Paid domestic work is not slavery, but it's certainly an occupation where there's all kinds of just basic labor violations, as well as more very intimate violations of personal dignity. So there are domestic worker organizations in places like Long Island and San Francisco and Los Angeles There's quite a cadre of attorneys and grassroots organizers who are also working on the ground. There is legislation at both the state and federal level to provide some basic labor rights to domestic workers. So I don't think, you know, we're in, you know, quite a, although at times certain live-in jobs do approach a kind of feudal-like arrangement.
Someone told me today, you know, you're living in someone's home, you're eating their food. It can be very intimidating for a young person in particular.
That's right. And that's right. For a young person or for women divided by class, culture, legal status. I mean, it just goes on and on.
Well, we have a lot of listeners who want to chime in as part of this discussion as well. Let's go to Arlington, Massachusetts first. We want to hear from Catherine. Hi, Catherine. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I called because the term mommy wars, I think, plays into something which contributes to this. I'm an at-home mom now. I have friends who are nannies. I have friends who work. I have friends myself who have taken the financial hit to stay home. And when it comes to the base level with all of us at the playground, you know, it really is about the kids. The financial ramifications, though, I know plenty of nannies who are well underpaid and suffer the things you talk about, but the perception of at-home mothers as being somehow adversarial to working mothers, it also feeds into the feeling of we dropped out. And I recently looked up and said, you know what, I didn't drop out, I changed jobs, but what I do is not perceived as a job by people who are professionally employed. If it is not perceived as a job by people who are professionally unemployed, then, of course, the people they hire to do what I do is not perceived as a job on some level, because any idiot can do it on some, you know, is the kind of the perception. Any idiot, our moms are moms, any idiot can do it. Come on.
Until they try it, and then they find out it's a lot harder than they imagined.
Well, I think you're bringing up a really important issue, and that is the general devaluing of women's work. I mean, in part, nanny work and domestic work of all sort is disrespected because it's seen as women's natural labor of love. Anybody can do it. Women do this routinely, mothers and wives. So to really bring about fundamental change requires a much deeper revolution of learning to value care.
All right, Catherine, thanks so much for the call. Let's go to Madison, Wisconsin next and hear from Ann. Hello, Ann.
Hello. My question has to do with what I see are lots of mothers who don't have a nanny, who are working and who are, you know, trying to spend time with their kids, enjoying spending time with their kids, working as well. And so I just think that that might be what social historians are writing about in 50 or 100 years, this, you know, this block of women who of different incomes who are working, who are taking care of their kids without a nanny. And I just wanted to hear your comments on that.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Ann. And it's a legitimate point. We should probably also point out, Caitlin and Pirette, that many women work not because they necessarily want to, but because many households now require two incomes just to get by.
Sure. Yeah, it's indisputable.
This was actually a major focus of the essay in The Atlantic that I wrote, was that we tend to lump all working moms together as though, you know, the ones who are working in glamorous, highly paid jobs are having the same problems and are sort of forced to work and are sort of oppressed, just the way that women who really would much rather stay home and raise their children are. And, of course, that's not true at all. I think the interesting thing that's happened and that's making it such a bind to be a mom nowadays is that not only do you have all these women working so that you take away all those hours of their week with working, but raising children has become so much more labor intensive so that, you know, you're not only working, but you've somehow got to get your kid to Taekwondo and to music class and to tutoring and to this and to that. Whereas in the old days, you know, my mother went back to work as part of the women's movement in the 1970s. And guess what I got? I got a key. You know, you were a latchkey kid in the 70s. We don't have middle-class latchkey kids anymore. If mom is working or if mom's home, no matter what, somehow or another, the kid is being chauffeured around to these endless activities. And that, too, becomes an extra burden on moms, whether working or at home.
You know, I think it's time to hear from a dad. Let's go to Marty now, who's in Tingsboro, Massachusetts. Hi, Marty.
Good evening. Thank you for taking my call. I've been an at-home dad for almost 5 years. of two beautiful little girls, my first of which is a special needs child. She was born 8 weeks early, and I kind of feel right at home right now because I'm usually the only dad in the room when the conversation starts happening that knows what it's really like to be an at-home parent.
And Marty, what would you say to other dads? I mean, it almost sounds as if we're kind of letting the dads off the hook here. You know, why is this just a dilemma for moms and not so much for dads?
It's a dilemma for any family who feels trapped that they have to have that two income, and it just happens to be that the dad can make more. It just happened to be in our family that my wife had the ability to make more money and the career path to keep going. But I'll tell you, the minute she walks in the door, her feet hit the floor running, and she turns right into supermom. She starts doing it. My reason for wanting to call so badly, though, was right at the beginning, the viewpoint that was made by your guest, Caitlin, I believe was the name, the moms that are out there doing so many more extraordinary things than taking care of their kids. I think the most extraordinary thing in the world you can do today is stay home and take care of your kids.
Marty, that is a point really well taken. Even as the words were coming out of my mouth, I tried to reshape the end of the sentence, and I didn't do a good job with it. I tried to take it back. I'm trying to suck the words back now in the studio. I was wrong to have said it, and point taken. You're absolutely right. There is nothing more extraordinary or important than that. And I will also note, Marty, I've done a lot of radio shows in the last couple of years on topics like this, and there's always a parent, an at-home parent. It's interesting. Every single show, someone with a special needs child is called in, and I'm just very impressed by these parents who are staying home, and there's just even more, you know, intense need for an actual parent to be home raising the child. So my hat is off to you, and I apologize from the bottom of my heart for having said that to you.
Thank you. I could hear it in the tone of voice that as soon as you were saying it, you were trying to suck it back in.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the call, Marty. And Caitlin, what about the dads? You know, are they able to pick up some of the slack in different ways? Because I get the sense, maybe I'm wrong, that parents now are often more involved with their children's everyday lives, perhaps even more so than those idyllic 50s couples where, you know, dad went off to the office and mom stayed home and baked cookies.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I've been in this discussion, as I was saying, on Slate magazine for the last few days, and one of the women in the discussion with me is Barbara Ehrenreich with me, and I just think she's so smart and so wise. And she said that my article should have been called not How Serfdom Saved the Women's Movement, but rather How Serfdom Saved Male Privilege, and that because the man wouldn't really agree to do enough housework, he was still being treated like a king in his house because he had a nanny, a female nanny, to kind of handle his half of the work and the wife to handle the other half of the work. But I think what I noticed in professional class couples is that professional class men who are married to career women, they help out. They have a real sense of fairness about it. They're not the kind of men who want traditional marriages, or they wouldn't have married career women. The problem is that men have such different standards about housekeeping than women do. And if I'm out doing something all night and I come in and my husband has this grin on his face like he's just done me the biggest favor and the house is a mess and the kids have gone to bed late and there's a pizza box and I'm just madder than a wet hen. And so that's where nannies come into play, is kind of even out the niceness of the domestic work.
All right. Well, Caitlin and Perrette, stay with us. We're going to be back in just a moment after a break to continue our discussion about professional class women and the nannies that they may be exploiting. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harris, in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about professional class women joining the workforce and sometimes leaving their children to sometimes underpaid nannies. We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're speaking this hour with Caitlin Flanagan, contributing editor of the Atlantic Monthly. Her article, How Serfdom Saved the Women's Movement, is in the current issue of the magazine. And also we have with us Perrette Hundenyu Sotelo, who is author of Domestica, Immigrant Workers Cleaning and Caring in the Shadows of Affluence. And, Perrette, I know you're going to have to go in just a couple of minutes, so I'd be curious to know if you have a closing thought, or also, do you have a favorite story that emerged as you were working on this book? There must be some doozies out there.
You know, there are so many stories, but I think I'd like to go back to something Caitlin suggested earlier, the sort of aha moment that she said she got about having immigrant workers working in her house and perhaps under harsh working conditions. I think it's important for us to listen to sort of the political backdrop, the larger political discourse in our country about immigrants, which for about 20 years now has been a very xenophobic one. And I think there sort of needs to be a connection made between American reliance on immigrant workers and this larger anti-immigrant politics. So clearly, so many industries, so many homes, so many families are entirely dependent on the labor of immigrant workers. And I'm hopeful that might be, that recognition might be an avenue for reform, for a new kind of legalization program that we're desperately in need of in a country with as many as 10 million undocumented immigrant workers.
And no question in your mind that it is easier for these people to be overlooked because they're poor and because they may be here illegally and often don't want the government to know about them. So Social Security for them is not necessarily a plus.
That's right. It's sort of a mixed bag. But there are, certainly we did have a big amnesty legalization program here in 1986. As a result, there are many nannies who are immigrant women who are U.S. citizens who have complete work authorization and still find themselves grappling with some of the bad working conditions that their undocumented peers do.
Well, Perrette, we'll have to say goodbye to you. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Gail. A pleasure. And Caitlin, I really enjoyed your story. We haven't spoken since it came out.
Thank you. Thank you. It's an honor to be on with you tonight.
So, Caitlin, let me throw it back to you. One of the other pieces here is who takes care of the nanny's children? You know, if this is someone who is an immigrant mom, I mean, isn't that part of the problem as well, that we're sort of foisting the children down the chain here? She's got to have somebody to take care of her kids, and who's that going to be?
Absolutely. And the really heartrending part of all of this is that so many of these immigrant women have had to leave their children in their home countries. And I don't have words for it. When the nanny who works next door has four children in Guatemala. She's been here for 10 years. She's perfectly legal. She has a really good job, et cetera. But her work is, can you imagine, number one, to leave your small children in another country? Can you imagine that, number one? And number two, to have your work be the intimate care of someone else's children. And yet she comes every day. She's a cheerful sort of person. That sounds patronizing, but she at least is smiling and jokes and laughs and visits at our house. And I know lots of women. I know lots of women who are doing that. So and I don't know what the answer to that piece of the puzzle is. I really don't know. But it's heartrending.
It is. Let's go to Salem, Massachusetts now and hear from Amy. Hi, Amy.
Hi. I had a couple of comments. Some of them have gotten addressed in the meantime. I should start by saying that I feel guilty because while I've been hanging on the phone waiting to talk on the show, I've been neglecting my daughter who wants to play a game or something. But I really groaned when I heard the beginning of the show, when I heard the title of the article, and when I heard the way that you framed the discussion as blaming feminism for this, because I think that takes a straw man definition of feminism as that what feminism is about allowing, upper middle class and upper class women to enter professional occupations and earn lots of money. And, I know tons of feminists and women in the women's movement, and not a single one of them views feminism as that.
And what do they view it as?
I think, if anything, they view it much more in terms of some of the other things that have come up in the discussion, like valuing caring work, for example, reframing the whole way that we remunerate and respect different kinds of roles in society. They view it as helping those women who, because of complicated combinations of gender issues and race issues and class issues, are really the most exploited, among whom obviously are the nannies that you're talking about. I mean, that's what the women's movement is all about.
I know that has a part in it,
and so but on the media, you're always hearing, you know, feminism is about, you know, women, you know, going on Wall Street and making lots of money and stuff. And I just think that that's kind of a straw man.
Well, this is where I'm really confused about feminism, because I have to keep going back to the Slate magazine exchange. Not that I'm at all promoting that anyone should read it. It's kind of horrible. But I was in this discussion with two prominent feminists, and I kept trying to bring the debate back to one very simple, simple fact, that people who hire domestic workers ought to pay them Social Security. And these two feminists kept changing the subject. One of them kept going back to Walmart, and Walmart is so terrible, and Walmart exploits its workers. Well, indeed it does. It's terrible, and it exploits its workers. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about these domestic workers. I have read a lot about feminism, and I know a lot about feminism. People don't think I do, but indeed I do. And I'm tremendously moved, and my life has obviously been changed by the things that happened during second wave feminism. In the 60s, in the 70s. But as I look at it today, in 2004, I'm on the radio all the time about this article. I can't get any feminists to engage in a discussion with me about bettering the lives of these domestic workers. I can't. I'm fed up with these feminists. I can't get one to discuss it with me.
Amy, thanks for the call. And let's quickly go for one more call, very quickly if you can, Mike, in Lincoln, Massachusetts. Hi.
Hey, Caitlin, it's Mike from Lincoln. I've got four sons, and I just want to tell you that I absolutely adore your writing. And last summer I was making copies of the article that you wrote for Atlantic Monthly and passing it out to Little League games. So great job, and thanks a million for all your good work. My point is, one of the dynamics that I've noticed is that in most jobs, employees will do anything to please their bosses so that they can keep their jobs. And a lot of cases, as I see here in the suburbs of Boston, the employers will do anything, because they're almost beholden to their nannies, to keep them. And I was just wondering if you might comment on that. And thanks again for your wonderful writing.
Thanks, Mike. Caitlin, we have just about a minute or so left.
Well, I'm felling here in Santa Monica, but I'll move forward to say that, you know, one of the things that I wrote kind of an open letter to domestic workers in Slate magazine, and one of the things that I said to them was, you know, your boss, if she's a working woman, she probably needs you more than you need her if you live in a city that has a high need for nannies, so you may be able to renegotiate. I think the caller is absolutely correct that some people, the nanny is the key that makes it all work.
Caitlin Flanagan, thanks so much for your comments. Appreciate you being with us. Earlier in the hour, we also heard from Pirette Hondenyo Sotelo. You can continue the conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on Forums. In just a moment, remembering the deadly Rhode Island nightclub fire 1 year ago today. This is On Point. One year ago today, fire raged through the Station nightclub in Rhode Island. It was the deadliest inferno in the state's history, killing 100 people and injuring hundreds more. And today, on the first anniversary of the February 20th disaster, partly revamped fire codes took effect in that state. But many other safety measures and regulations identified after the Station disaster have yet to be implemented. Last night, survivors, friends, and victims' loved ones gathered for the first Station Fire Remembrance. They shared some of their thoughts and hopes 1 year after the deadly blaze.
My right eye is completely blind. My left eye is probably about maybe 30% now, I would say 25%. It's gradually gotten better where, you know, if I sit directly in front of the TV, I could see a little bit.
Hello, my friend, we meet again. It's been a while, we're lot of headaches, a lot of sleepless nights, and a lot of oversleeping. You're so physically and emotionally drained.
Mine's more that I didn't get hurt, the guilt. I don't cry as much as I used to, but for months, I couldn't even talk about it because I would just start bawling my eyes out. I do believe there is a reason why everything happens in life now. That one thing, the fire, made me understand that anything can happen tomorrow to anybody at any point in time, but it doesn't help the guilt. My sacrifice.
I had to go to a specialized hand therapist for my hands, which are still a mess. My right hand is a lot better now, where I can actually, you know, pick up a fork and feed myself and sign my name and stuff. We're seeing our share of ups and downs, or how quickly life can turn around
in an instant. It feels so good to reunite within yourself and within your mind. Let's find peace there, 'cause when you are with me. It's just such a permanent marking on your soul anyway, that a permanent marking on your skin doesn't even start to compare, but it brings it out in the open. Almost brings your pain out in the open.
When they get the skin for this surgery here, they're going to take it probably from my stomach, so I'm going to get like a free tummy tuck. And you know, when they take the scar under my chin out, they have a chin lift 10 years before I need it. I mean, other people pay lots of money for those.
Is it because of the fact that it was a no-name or has-been band, or whatever you want to put it, from the 80s, heavy metal band that, you know, playing in a small club in a small town in a small state that, I don't know, I mean, if it was a, you know, Dave Matthews concert or Aerosmith concert and 100 people die at a concert, I think there'd be, a lot of, musicians coming together and doing a benefit. I mean, they have Farm Aid and Live Aid and all these other big concerts.
I've been drowning myself. I work about 60 hours a week right now. Just keeps me busy, keeps my mind focused on something besides that. 'Cause when
it helps immensely to go out there and know that everyone you meet is either friends with, related to, lives next door to someone that didn't make it out or someone that's injured. It stinks that so many people were injured, but it's a lot easier for us to be around others who are injured. 'Cause when you are with me, I'm free, I'm careless, I believe.
I just want to say hello again. I just want to say hello again.
Donovan Williams, Renee Bork, Linda Fisher, and Julie Malini are all survivors of the Station nightclub fire. Mike Kaz, also a fire survivor, performed the song My Sacrifice last night at the Station Fire Remembrance in West Warwick, Rhode Island. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, Julie Jopp, Chris O'Connor, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skoog. We had help today from Jim Moses and Stephen Belter. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook. He'll be back on Monday. This is On Point.